Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson says that our American economic collapse looks familiar. He's seen it before in Russia, Argentina, South Korea, Malaysia. In, he says, banana republics, countries in the pocket of elites unable or unwilling to make necessary reforms. In the U.S., a financial elite, oligarchs, he does not hesitate to call them, who got carried away and are still not reined in. This hour on Point, Simon Johnson on where we stand now in the economic crisis and why. Joining me now from Washington is Simon Johnson. He's former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He blogs on the economy at baselinescenario.com. His provocative essay in the May issue of the Atlantic Monthly is headlined, "The Quiet Coup." Simon Johnson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Banana Republic, strong language. What's the point you're making?
It is strong language, and I think the point is we need to wake up and smell the coffee. We let the financial sector get too big, too powerful economically, and too powerful, far too powerful politically. It's happened before. It's happened in other countries, and we need to address the situation head on. If we do it, and we do it quickly, and we don't waste time, then I think we can have an economic recovery in the next couple of years. If we putz around and have inappropriate policies, it'll take us a lot longer.
A lot longer, perhaps, and what you warn could be, quoting you, worse than the Great Depression. You say that the American situation today would be familiar to international monetary teams, IMF teams, that have gone into emerging economies over the last decade and more to pull them out of crises. Familiar how?
Well, I'm not making this up. This is actually things that IMF officials, my friends, people I've worked with there. I spent 4 out of the last 5 years at the IMF, roughly. This is what they say to me. They say, you know, how did this happen in the United States, kind of while we were sleeping? We allowed a financial elite to develop that became enormously powerful. It twisted and moved regulations in its favor. It was able to run a series of booms and or bubbles, if you prefer that term, that turned out not to be sustainable. It generated income that we counted as part of GDP that was probably illusory, and now it's all a burst, and we're struggling to deal with the consequences because that same financial elite is blocking progress and blocking reform. And this is exactly the same story. It plays out in different ways in different countries, but it's exactly the same story we've seen in many middle-income countries, open to capital flows that have had repeated crises. And it's something we've seen also in poorer countries, those that have ever managed to get any growth going.
But, you know, we're all familiar, I guess, or we think we are, with business cycles, with animal spirits in capitalism. When you say a banana republic, a financial elite, oligarchs, it suggests a kind of malign intent, a kind of a maliciousness or, you know, nefarious politics. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think that oligarchs anywhere, you know, are necessarily or always bad people. And I think many of the things that are done in lots of countries around the world that we don't like when we see it from the outside are actually completely legal and in conformance with all the norms if you live in that country. So I don't actually mean that. I don't mean the term oligarch in a particularly pejorative or normative sense.
Sounds pretty pejorative in your essay, Simon Johnson, I have to say. I don't know anybody who uses it as a synonym for fairy godmother or, you know, benign, benevolent. You name it.
It's a description of an elite and a powerful small elite that has an enormous amount of political clout. When we see it in other countries, we have no trouble calling that an oligarchy. When we see it in our own country, we blanch at the term. And obviously, I'm trying to sugarcoat it a little bit for your audience, so they'll actually go read the article and not dismiss it out of hand. But I think if you look at the political process, look at how it's been affected by these financial interests, and look at how it's changed since roughly 1980, and how much more important the financial sector has become in this country. For example, Eisenhower talked at the end of the 50s about a military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. He was concerned about the power of manufacturing and the power of military contractors, the political power of those entities in the U.S. Economy. It's not about – the military-industrial complex is not particularly powerful in the U.S. right now. It's a financial complex, a Wall Street-Washington corridor of power that's really running things.
So tease out then the difference in your mind between a big, powerful economy – with financial institutions and wealthy citizens within it that might be healthy. And what you're describing here is something unhealthy as a banana republic oligarchy driven into a ditch in the United States case, as you make it. What's the difference? Tease out the elements that make you say, wait, this isn't just a big economy gone bad. This is a big economy that's the victim, what your headline says, of the quiet coup.
Well, I think, Tom, you made a good point a few moments ago when you talked about business cycles. We're used to the idea that there's ups and downs. Sometimes an economy like the U.S. grows faster. Sometimes it grows slower. But the kind of collapse we've seen in the financial system, the kind of meltdown that we saw in September and October, and the kinds of struggles that we have with credit. Basically, credit right now in the U.S. economy is held up by the actions of the Federal Reserve. The government has, one way or another, nationalized almost the entire credit system through default. No one else will lend, and the Fed has become the backstop or even the front stop for most credit in the economy. This is not ordinary business cycle kind of activities. This is the kind of crisis, the kind of problems you see once every 50 or 100 years. And that's the President Obama's description of the situation, too. This is not me exaggerating. This is President Obama saying we have the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And you, whenever you have a massive crisis like this, you have to look at the deeper underlying causes. And you have to dig, you know, it's not about AIG bonuses. It's not about arrogance of CEOs and major financial institutions. It's much deeper about the structure of our economy and the structure of our political system and the way it's become intertwined with the financial sector. That is exactly what has happened many times in emerging markets. And initially, of course, it feeds into a boom. Initially, the power of the financial sector can actually be helpful for sustaining growth. It attracts more foreign capital. People invest more. But it's not sustainable. It blows up in your face. And unfortunately, regrettably, sadly, it has blown up in our face in the U.S. situation. And of course, the people who are going to get hammered, who are getting hammered the most, are the people who didn't participate particularly in the boom and the bubble, the people who are getting laid off and people who are being driven down into poverty. That, again, I have to say, is a totally classic emerging market symptom.
So go to that deeper structure as you see it in the United States, Simon Johnson, and where you see it as having gone off the rails.
Well, it's interesting. It's hard to put your finger on the moment when it went off the rails. It was a gradual process, and the title of the article was not chosen by me. It was chosen by Don Peck and his colleagues at The Atlantic. But I like the title, The Quiet Coup.
Mm.
And the idea is that they were trying to convey was that this happened without us really paying attention. We knew there was deregulation. We knew that the financial sector had gone out and had become bigger. We knew that partnerships on Wall Street had become public corporations and were able to mobilize more capital. But we didn't really see the entire picture. We all saw parts of it, but no one that I know was sufficiently worried about the way that the system had begun to operate. And while we thought, you know, that there were some bubble-type phenomenons and people certainly were worried about subprime housing, I don't know anyone who was saying that there's really a meta-bubble here, that the financial services sector has become too big. And this is not just a problem for sort of diversion of effort in the economy, but it's actually a problem for the political economy that leads you into crisis and that you need to solve and sort out in order to get out of a crisis like the one we face now.
You describe a country almost sort of hypnotized also by a set of ideas that we thought of, I think, as openly discussed. I mean, the Reagan Revolution and market forces, much of the country openly, voluntarily embraced, saw if the majorities at the polls are any indication, you know, saw as a great motor for economic growth and prosperity. But you describe it as not just a power grab, but also a kind of an ideologically, I don't know, hypnosis trick that was done on the country. Am I right in reading you that way?
Well, it's an interesting term, but I don't think it was quite as – I'm not saying it's a conscious conspiracy. I'm saying it's a system that has evolved. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that anybody did anything, you know, illegal or definitely wanted to manipulate things quite – or had the power to manipulate things in quite the controlling manner, I think, that your hypnosis metaphor suggests. Mm. But I am definitely saying that the way the oligarchy works in the United States is fairly sophisticated, and it's much more – it's not about violence. It's not particularly about corruption and overt bribery. It's much more about ideas, controlling ideas. It's much more about the personnel who move back and forth between Wall Street and Treasury. And, of course, when you make this point, people, they say, well, that's true, but who else do you want to run Treasury? Surely the people who run Wall Street know how this should be done, and they are the right people to run Treasury. And, of course, experts must be involved in this kind of situation. But I would point out that we are usually more comfortable with the Department of Defense being run by a civilian or not being run by a serving general. And that's because we think that civilians should control the military. We think we'd like to have a strong military. We like many things about the way our military operates. But we do think civilian oversight by somebody who really knows how it's done and how to run something as big and as complicated as the military, but who was not a serving soldier, that is the right way to go.
But instead, of course, as you point out, we've had Robert Rubin, who came right from Wall Street to be Secretary of Treasury. We've had Hank Paulson, who came right from Goldman Sachs, to do the same. Simon Johnson writes, just as we, the U.S., have the world's most advanced economy, military, and technology, we also have its most advanced oligarchy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about where we stand now in the global economic meltdown and why, with former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson, now professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, and Kathy. Kathy, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Hi, Kathy.
Yes, I can't hear you very well, so I just want to say my comment briefly. I want to say that I agree with and support Mr. Simon and what he's saying. I teach sociology, and for years, people in my field have been talking about the reality of that. And I don't think that we can really create reform politically, economically, and otherwise until we really do get below the surface and down to the real causes of the problems that we have. And those are the issues that I deal with every day in my job.
Down to real causes, says the sociologist. Simon Johnson, you suggest in your essay that we're not there, we're not getting there yet. What would it take if we've got an oligarchy that has had a bad effect on the economy? Certainly, the economy's in trouble. You're the former IMF guy. You know, whether by their formulas or your own, what would it take? What will it take to get us out of this?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to talk about it openly and we have to argue it out. I think that's a good thing about having a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I would say that more analysis and more thinking, including or maybe even particularly from sociology, makes a lot of sense to me. The New York Times had a special section last week, their deal book. People put together a section on what's going on in the financial sector. And they had a brilliant page, a graphic, showing the network of connections and actually political contributions between leading financiers and leading politicians, people in power today in the United States. It was quite dramatic and something very much out of sort of network analysis from sociology. We need to figure out how to integrate that into our thinking about decisions and what is appropriate and not appropriate level of political participation by very powerful people.
But reach over from your economist realm then into the sociologist realm a little bit. I mean, we talked a bit already, but the thinking that empowered, enabled, what kept financiers so high in the American sociological pyramid for so long was held by an awful lot of people in this country, millions and millions who poured their hard-earned savings into that market in the belief that it would work for them too. I think people are struggling now to figure out what perspective to take going forward. I mean, are you saying that's wrong? People have bought into that for a long time, invested a lot in that view of the world and the economy.
No, I think we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think saving is an important thing that individuals need to do for their retirement, for their kids' education, and so on. And I think that perhaps we overhyped the equity market as a way to save, but we certainly want people, in fact, this country as a whole needs to save more in order to make the kinds of investments that we all wish we had going on. So I'm not at all saying close down the markets or you know, take a sledgehammer to the system. I am saying that we should acknowledge and address this concentration of economic and political power that's come about, and we should recognize that when power becomes this concentrated, it's not in the interests of most people. And this is not saying that you know, we shouldn't have markets either in general or in particularly around financial instruments, but it is saying that we should watch out for concentrations of power. Concentrations of power almost certainly develop everywhere where there's an opportunity, and these go very badly for everyone except the most connected, powerful people.
Concentrations of power that you describe having flowed from hyper-concentrations of wealth. Let's go to New York. Hector, New York, and Roger. Roger, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
All right. What do you know?
I think Simon has some very interesting thoughts. Particularly, I would like to wonder why no one has made more of the 25 partners at Goldman Sachs that received $25 million bonuses each, not a year or 2 years before they went public. Perhaps what I'm suggesting would be that the Goldman Sachs knew what AIG's situation was, that they knew what was coming down the pike, that they paid their people off and then got a burst of cash when they went public, and then some of their top people end up at AIG. So I'd like to hear what Simon thinks of that.
Professor Johnson.
Yeah, I don't know the details at the level of granularity that I think the caller is asking for. And I think my understanding is that Goldman Sachs went public considerably before the AIG took the massive plunge into credit
yes.
default swaps that led to its financial ruin. However, I think that, you know, the point he's making about opening up the box and studying carefully interconnections and maybe thinking more about what kinds of connections are allowed. If you have this much money and if you have this much influence in the functioning of Wall Street, what kinds of activities should you be allowed to do in terms of sitting on boards, in terms of interconnected or activities that we didn't previously think involved a conflict of interest. But maybe now we should go back and revise all the rules and procedures around that. And perhaps it should be the case that the more money you make, the more constraints there are on your activities, rather than, I think, the opposite, which is what currently happens.
I think Roger's suggestion or question may have been, though, whether there was a kind of knowing push on into this very bad terrain we're in now, that the financiers who you're critical of in this essay could see where this was headed and milked it while, you know, millions of what turned out to be kind of suckers sat in the market and eventually got clobbered.
Well, I wouldn't want to suggest that the financial wizards were actually as smart as they claim to be, because obviously they lost a lot of money too.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, perhaps there's a tension in what I'm saying between but I think you resolve it by saying, look, there's a system that they built that enabled them to make a massive amount of money. There were a lot of miscalculations. I don't think they intended to blow up a large part of the world financial system. I think that was inadvertent, and it just shows you that they themselves didn't know how the system was going to operate and how it was going to affect their own firms and their own salaries and their own people. And nevertheless, they are now resisting, in my opinion, the kinds of sensible change that you'd need to have in order to sort out this financial mess. For example, the new resolution authority that Secretary Geithner and Chairman the Fed Ben Bernanke requested just recently from Congress, and it's still under debate. That resolution authority, I think, could be the beginning of much more sensible change in the financial sector. I can assure you, it is going to be opposed tooth and nail by some very powerful financial interests, because they don't want the government to have that kind of power over mega banks.
Let's go to Matt in Somerville, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
I wanted to ask Professor Johnson if it was his opinion that Geithner and Summers, for example, are unable to see this level of see the forest for the trees because of their involvement in the financial sector. Having come from that world, are they blinded to these meta issues that you're talking about, or do you think they're capable of seeing the issues that you're talking about? I asked this because yesterday in the news, I, along with millions of people, I think, was puzzled by the CEO of GM having to step down when no such concession was asked of Wall Street. It made me think that's because Geithner and Summers are friends with these guys and didn't have the wherewithal to ask them to step down.
Yeah, Matt, let us pick it up. Simon Johnson, you go at this point in your piece. You remind us Robert Rubin, former Secretary of Treasury, was once co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. Henry Paulson, CEO of Goldman Sachs. And right on down, John Snow, you know, came out of private equity. And what, Alan Greenspan went off to the international bond market. Can they see the meta picture that you're describing, or would they listen to what you're saying and say, come on, Simon, you're over the top?
Some people are listening, Tom. I don't know how many, and I don't know how seriously, but people are starting to listen. And it's not just coming from me, of course. It's coming from other people who are not radicals by any means. I was chief economist at the IMF. That's a very mainstream job. Mm. I'm a very mainstream economist, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I just happen to have worked in lots of crisis situations around the world. I have a very open mind on Secretary of the Treasury Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, who's head of the National Economic Council and the key economic advisor in the White House. Both of them, these are people whose careers are related to finance, but they're not Wall Street financiers themselves. Tim Geithner is a career civil servant who most recently was president of the New York Fed. Larry Summers is an outstanding academic who spent a long time in the Treasury in the 1990s, but he's a very smart guy. Both of them worked on lots of crisis situations around the world. And I, for one, am willing to – I see myself actually as a supporter of both of them, a supporter perhaps from the outside who's pushing them in a certain direction, because I know there's other people on the outside and the inside who are pushing them from other directions towards the interests of Wall Street. And I think one way you can be supportive in this situation is by making arguments and bringing people with you more broadly. And that feeds into, obviously, political calculations as well as the economic analysis. I do think your caller, Matt, puts his finger on a very interesting point this week, which is how come the government fires or pushes out the CEO of General Motors, whereas a few weeks ago, perhaps a month ago now, the government, the Treasury, actually, in a background briefing, assured reporters that the CEO of Citigroup, Mr. Vikram Pandit, would stay on as CEO. Now, that is absolutely a contrast, and I think a tension. I think when you have a major company that's got itself into trouble, and when you feel that the CEO is not being entirely cooperative, then it's taxpayer money that's going to save GM and that is already has already saved Citigroup repeatedly. Mm. Then I think you have to look at whether the board of directors needs to be changed and if you want to act more directly, whether the CEO should be encouraged to step down. And I think with this new resolution authority that's currently under discussion, if that goes through,
this is the public-private partnership to deal with toxic assets.
Well, no, actually the public-private partnership, I think, is a little bit of a red herring. That's the scheme in which you're going to give very loans on very easy terms to hedge funds so they can buy the toxic nonsense from the
banks. Oh, you're talking about fixing up the banks with the resolution.
Well, the resolution authority, Tom, is for the non-banks. There's this huge legal problem we have.
Okay, I'm trying to catch up here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It does move fast.
Yeah.
I put something on my blog about explaining this just this morning, so
yep.
I apologize.
Yep.
For springing this
no,
on you.
No, let's learn.
The point is that the U.S. government has a lot of authority to intervene and to take over and to sort out banks that have retail deposits. So they're insured by the FDIC and they have retail depositors.
Right.
And that system actually works rather well. But that doesn't work for mega banks in part because these mega banks, the very big brand name banks that we all discuss, and I'm not saying any particular one of them is in trouble, but there's lots of discussion around Citigroup or around Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
These are holding companies that have some regulated activities, some activities with retail deposits, but a lot of things that aren't retail deposits.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the lawyers who've looked at this say that the government can't come in and intervene in on the same basis. So you'd have to, if you felt these guys were insolvent and you wanted to push the issue, you would have to force them into bankruptcy. Bankruptcy for a massive corporation like that is a very messy operation. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly indiscriminate in terms of how the losses are spread. If the government can come in with a proper intervention authority, then they could actually, as necessary, and I think it will be necessary, they could clean up these banks and they could take bankruptcy type actions, but on a more reasoned and reasonable basis, and limit a lot of the collateral damage.
Mm. Simon Johnson is with us. He is author of the new essay in the Atlantic Monthly May issue, "The Quiet Coup." So, Simon, then that's what I guess you've been clamoring for a long time. You write here that if the IMF were in charge, if it was one of the quote-unquote banana republics that they've dealt with, that's more or less what they would do. They would come in, nationalize the banks, quickly break them up, clean them up, get them back into the market on a private basis. Do you see the Obama administration now moving in the direction of what you've been clamoring for a while?
I think they're moving in the right direction. Now, they have said, President Obama has said that nationalization is off the table. That's his call, and I respect that. I think we should move on, take that as a given. And if this kind of government takeover nationalization strategy is not available, then I think getting this resolution authority and using it appropriately, and we're putting ideas out there about how to use it, when and on what basis. I think that could be the next best solution. I am not saying, but let me be very clear, I'm not saying there's a magic bullet. I'm not saying there's any way out of this financial mess that isn't painful, doesn't involve a lot of job losses, and I'm also not saying that this is going to be quick. I mean, I think we're at best a 2-year process of sorting out the financial mess. And, of course, the real economy, people's willingness to spend and continue spending in a responsible manner, that's really the key driver to the recovery that interacts with confidence or loss of confidence in the financial sector. But the recovery of our real economy is critical. And just to further complicate things, the recovery of economies around the world is critical. And that's, of course, why the G20 meeting this week is so really very important, because we need other economies at least not to screw up really badly and not to push themselves into a further downward spiral, of which there's a very real risk in Europe right now.
We'll look at that. Let me get a call here from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you know, Elizabeth?
Well, I know an awful lot, and I just want to say I agree with everything that the callers are calling in and Simon is saying. I've recently written a book, and it's called Wingtip Shoes, Memoirs of a Flight Attendant, and it's a philosophical take on the world. And what I feel is everything that he's saying is that the top 10% have controlled the world. I'm not saying it's good and I'm not saying it's bad. It's just what it is.
Did you see that as a flight attendant, Elizabeth? Did you
figure
it out at 30,000 feet?
A philosophy, businesswoman,
right?
Entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a family that started companies. And I saw this in the world, and I've met these people through 40 years of flying. And I lost my job through TWA, through Carl Icahn and the corporate raiders. I've lived it. I've been there, and I've written a book. And it's a very interesting time, because we are entering, in my mind, a world of conscious awareness. And that's where we are right now. And we have to do this to heal the wounds, that the things that have happened in our world. We need to bond together. It's amazing what's happening. It's heart-wrenching. People are losing jobs. I mean, everything. But we still are at a point. It's kind of like a cleansing of the soul. And that's all. That's what I see. And I just hope that readers will pick up the book on an Amazon Borders and Barnes.
Elizabeth, thanks very much, Simon. The business goes on right there. But what about the point? Open eyes. Awakening of the soul, is that the kind of language you would use? Or is that the kind of, just human dynamic you see is partly, necessary here, beyond the sheer mechanics of the economics to get things righted?
I have no problem with that language at all. I think waking up and smelling the coffee is what I call it. Mm. But if you want to call it social awareness and consciousness, that is fine. The point I would stress, though, really interesting point from what Elizabeth's saying, is she's clearly got a background in entrepreneurship. Her family started companies. Mm-hmm. That's my background, too. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship at MIT. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time hanging out with business people, talking to people who are starting companies, talking to venture capital. They agree with what I'm saying, too. They are annoyed with the way things have got distorted, and they think it gets in the way of technology creation and job creation and entrepreneurship in this country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about where we stand now in the global economic meltdown and why, with former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson. He now teaches entrepreneurship at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Let's get a call from Acton, Massachusetts. And Mark. Mark, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Hello, Dr. Johnson. I read your piece, and I thought it was terrific. My comment or question is this. In October, Alan Greenspan testified before Congress that he has spent his whole life following an ideology that said that looking to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity was the way to go. And he said that people like him that shared that ideology were in a state of, quote, shocked disbelief. And it's almost impossible to imagine someone coming out today with all that's happened and advocating for that position. But my question is, why was that doomed to fail, and how do we prevent it from rearing its ugly head again, and does it still dominate the thinking of those who are trying to get us through this financial crisis?
And Mark, by that, do you mean the faith in the self-correcting market dynamic?
Yeah, the idea that somehow that the people running these lending institutions out of self-interest would protect their shareholders' equity, and clearly they did not. And I think it fits in directly with how these people themselves were compensated.
Simon Johnson?
I think that's absolutely a great question. It's complicated to answer briefly. I would say that many of us, including myself, find that many market transactions are inherently democratic. So we like the fact that, you know, we can go around to a lot different venture capital firms with our entrepreneurial startup and pitch them. And if they like our idea, if mm-hmm. we, you know, have some good chemistry, we can raise money. There's a level of an access, an ease of access in the United States, which is, I think, quite unlike anything else in the world. I'm an immigrant, as you probably guess from my accent. And as a country that's open to people with opportunities, the U.S. is great. We've known for a long time that it doesn't come with a very strong social safety net. And that's, I think, increasingly a problem that we need to deal with. But the other problem that's really manifested itself more recently and much more clearly in the past year, and I think this is what shocked Alan Greenspan, is the way in which markets can generate concentrated economic and political power. Again, not a terrible surprise, and we have antitrust laws against certain kinds of concentrations of economic power, but the way in which these large banks became too big to fail and then used that and are using it today to their advantage is kind of shocking. General Motors, for example, is obviously not too big to fail. That's what President Obama said on national television. He said bankruptcy may be necessary. Right, he's saying we'll help you do a deal without bankruptcy if we can get there, but we may need to go to bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. He cannot say that right now to the major banks in this country. He won't say it, and he feels he cannot say it that bankruptcy for those banks would be too dangerous. Now that is a situation that is not tolerable. We must not allow it to be repeated. And if you look at, for example, the work of a historian, Steve Haber at Stanford, who's looked at the history of financial development in the United States and other countries since 1800. Since the beginning of a modern economy, his point is that one advantage the U.S. had was we kept banks small and we stopped them from becoming too powerful politically through various rules, including not allowing them to be present in more than one state in general. Mm-hmm. And that this, compared to other countries, and this is Steve's view, compared to other countries such as Mexico, was a big advantage that the U.S. had. So fast forward or take that logic to today, that says that we went off track when we allowed the banks to become bigger. We thought we were getting efficiency gains. We thought this was market consistent. This was the Greenspan mistake that he's now acknowledging, and we should find a way to backtrack.
Let's go to Dylan in Augusta, Georgia. We've got great questions coming in for you. Dylan, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for taking my call. I have one question. I read American Theocracy by Kevin Phillips, and he says that since 2005, the percentage of GDP with respect to real actual produced goods in this country has gone down, whereas and was surpassed by the a higher percentage based on financial services mm-hmm. and trading of non-real goods and just financial markets and money.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you see any way of correcting that trend and possibly going back to the way things used to be. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Dylan. Dr. Johnson.
Well, I think we can go back. We will go back. And in fact, we have no alternative because people are not going to want the same level of financial services in the future. This point about what happened to GDP since 2005 is really interesting. I think it'll take us some time to figure this out. But obviously, if you run scams and you rip people off, that shouldn't be part of GDP. GDP is supposed to be productive, sensible goods and services. It's
and yet,
okay
and yet
to count
it was all counted in there, the credit default swap action and everything else.
Well, the way you measure GDP is obviously pretty imperfect. But to the extent you earn revenue and right. you pay people's wages off crazy schemes, including, you know, by some interpretations, credit default part of credit default swap trading, mm-hmm. That probably shouldn't be counted as GDP. And it would not surprise me if we go back and you know, over some period of time, restate our GDP for the last 4 or 5 years and find that we were not growing anywhere near the rate that we thought we were.
But is this resetting then just a matter of, I don't know, restating GDP, of cutting back on financial activity that wasn't really productive? Or I think implicit in our question from Augusta is, do we have a real goods economy that can move in and take the place of the, high-tier hijinks that we've had in recent years?
Yes, we do have that kind of economy. We have that kind of ability. Obviously, I'm biased because I work at MIT, but I think we have, you know, much more generally a technology creation and development process in the United States, and an ability to bring ideas to market, real ideas. Mm. That is phenomenal. And if I think of all the great investments that I've seen and watched and consistently misunderstood and failed to invest my own money in coming out of MIT over the past 10, 20 years, I'm pretty confident that we will move much more of our economy into that direction. I think actually this is a big advantage of the U.S. relative to other countries. The entrepreneurial process that we have in the U.S. is not much damaged and may even be helped by this big crisis in financial services. As long as people can raise capital for their new businesses on some reasonable basis, a lot more people now are interested in careers in technology development.
Rather than financial, I don't know, manipulations. Let's go to Stamford, Connecticut, and Guy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. This is the question is kind of near and dear to my heart, but and I absolutely believe we're in a banana republic today, and I think the solutions are that before we can clean any of this up, is we have to get our senators and congressmen working for us, and right now I don't think they're doing that. I think they're working for big business, are working for their next campaign. They're working for how much money they can put in their coffers. You know, Dodd took $100,000 from AIG. Obama took $100,000 from AIG. AIG spent $53,000 a day for every day the Congress was in session last year on lobbying efforts. And it's just impossible to make any progress on any of this until we turn that situation around. We have to get to the heart of the matter, and everything else is periphery, in my opinion.
Guy, let me take that to our economist, if I may, and thanks for it. Simon Johnson, what do you say to Guy's observation?
Well, I think Guy's right that we need to think very hard about political contributions and the way lobbying operates. And I think many things should be changed about that, including some of the elements that he was getting at. I would not, however, want to say that all of Capitol Hill – I would not say they're all in the same boat. I work quite a lot with people on Capitol Hill who share the opinions that we're articulating today and are looking for sensible, concrete, practical ways to move things in the right direction. It's complex, and there are powerful interests working the other side. There's no question about it. But I do think there are senators and there are members of Congress who really get it and who understand that the financial sector got out of control. And I'm actually talking about people who are in the Democratic Party and people who are in the Republican Party, okay?
You say right in your essay, you know, we've got two big problems, a desperately ill banking sector and, quoting you, a political balance of power that gives the financial sector a veto over public policy even as that sector loses popular support.
Yes, well, we are, without any question, in a difficult spot. But I don't want to create the impression or support the view that everybody in Congress is absolutely, you know, lost to sensible thinking on this subject. Far from it. But I am recognizing, and the article is emphasizing that, and I think Guy's mm-hmm. call was reinforcing that there's a lot of money at stake here, and big business, you know, is well organized and has the ability, quite legally, to tip the balance massively in its favor. And let's watch the debate over this resolution authority. Currently, hearings before the House Financial Services Committee this week. And I think the questions asked and the way in which industry pushes back will be most informative for what our future holds.
Now, it's funny because I think back over the years that you described looking at other countries who have had crises and the IMF interventions, there was also a lot of criticism of how the IMF intervened in many countries over the years. But looking at the American example, you say the advice from the IMF on this front would be simple: break the oligarchy. Now, what does that mean in an American context? And are you suggesting that here?
Yes, I am suggesting that. I think that the most concrete thing you should do is make the big banks smaller. And I think we should think very hard about how large you let any kind of financial institution get in an economy like this. Now, I don't think it's necessary that this will avoid all future crises or abolish the business cycle. I think that would be an illusion. But allowing banks to become 10 to 20% of GDP, and then putting themselves in a position where you can't afford to bankrupt them or to close them down, that's not acceptable. And it couldn't get worse. By the way, in Europe, they've allowed their banks to become an order of magnitude bigger than in the U.S. So they have banks, individual banks. The Royal Bank of Scotland, for example, in the U.K. has a balance sheet which is 2 times. UK GDP, 200 times the size of the UK economy. And in their cases, they have things that are too big to rescue, let alone too big to fail. And that's really scary. And if we don't do something about it in this country, that's where we'll be headed.
Let's go to the G20 for a moment and what's going on there. Some remarkable language, talk about remarkable language coming out of Europe in recent days. I heard just this morning, I didn't catch the name, but some EU official or talking about the gang of pirates in the USA. That is, their way of describing the head of our financial system. We had the president of the EU. It's a rotating presidency. But this was the Czech Prime Minister, Mirek Topolánek. Talking about the Obama plan, big stimulus package, and the debt that came with it being the road to hell. What do you think about how the Europeans, the rest of the G20, are looking at the challenge in front of the global economy right now, vis-a-vis the American approach, Simon Johnson?
I think the Europeans don't get it at all. I think for all my complaints and criticism or gentle pushing of the U.S. government, I think we're far ahead. The Obama administration is far ahead of Europe in terms of understanding the depths of the problem we face and the need for dramatic action if we are to avoid something that will look and feel very much like the Great Depression. The Europeans really don't get it. It's a fascinating question why they don't get it. But basically, they're still in denial. They're still hoping that they're going to get a nice, smooth recovery later this year or the very latest in early 2010. And I think that they are kidding themselves, or at least that is not very likely. And I think President Obama's mission, which is, is a tough struggle at this summit, but he's making a little bit of progress at least, is to push the Europeans towards more positive, constructive policies, not just for themselves, but also with regard to how they impact the rest of the world.
But the argument that European leaders have made is that they have more social welfare, that their unemployment benefits are so strong, that their retirements have not been gutted like American retirements. They're secured by the state. They don't need the stimulus package because they already provide a level of built-in support for their citizens and economies that the United States doesn't. What do you say to that?
Oh, those are good points, but they're distractions. The main problem is that the European, the Eurozone, the core, the heart of the European economy, has a monetary policy that's far too tight. They need to follow the lead of Ben Bernanke on this. The big difference between the U.S. and Europe is not really on fiscal policy. We're doing things through conscious discretionary action that they do automatically. That's fine. There's a limit on how much you can do with fiscal action anyway. The real issue is monetary action. And the real problems in Europe are a collapse of the East European economy. The banks in Eastern Europe are owned by West European banks. So their entire financial system is taking another downturn. And they have a collapse of the property market in the U.K., Spain, and Ireland. And their exports are falling through the floor in the core central economies such as Germany and France. They are simply playing the fiddle while Rome burns.
So look at the global picture then. You write in your essay that what we face now could, in fact, be worse than the Great Depression if the right things aren't done. Where do you think we are in the arc of this crisis? And, if you had the next steps, A, B, and C to outline, what would they be in your book?
Well, we're obviously very early in the crisis. The period from 1929 to 1933 is when output really declined 20-25% in the Great Depression. We're only 6 months into our crisis. What we need to do is sort out the UK, the U.S. financial system in the way we've been talking about, mm-hmm. and that's very hard. We need to restore confidence through that and through the fiscal measures, and I think most importantly the monetary policy, expansionary monetary policy, I'm very supportive of what Ben Bernanke is currently doing, although I think it has risks, but it's the best that we can – it's what you have to do under these circumstances. And we have to prevent the world from really seriously damaging itself, and that's particularly in Europe. There's a lot of short-sightedness in Europe, and there's a lot of unwillingness to look at and to deal with these fundamental problems. The Obama administration, I think, is latched onto the view of approaching Europe indirectly through strengthening the International Monetary Fund and persuading then the IMF to take the lead in helping weaker Eurozone and East European countries. And I think, you know, again, not ideal, but very practical, sensible, and they can get some traction with that this week and going forward.
So early in the crisis, and what about in the disentangling of the American economy from what you describe as the sort of banana republic oligarchy? How far along are we on that, or have we begun? I guess you see hope in the resolution authority that Tim Geithner is pushing forward.
Well, I'm a constructive, fairly optimistic in general policy person, Tom, and I'm looking, you know, I try to take a very balanced view, and that's why the website is actually called the baseline scenario. We can revise our baseline up or we can revise it down. We're not you know, trying to exude negativity, and I want to recognize progress when I see it. So I think we're starting to move in the right direction. It will be a long, painful process, and honestly, at the end of the day, we will not get rid of elites. As Schumpeter said, and we quoted it in our article, everyone has elites. The important thing is to change them from time to time.
Change them from time to time. Simon Johnson, you get us thinking, and we're grateful for it. Thank you for the essay, and thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Simon Johnson, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, author of the essay in the Atlantic Monthly's May edition, The Quiet Coup. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.